automatically jump to the top of the list. But this is true today. Our sponsor for our speaker today is an accredited space agent. She is the president and owner of Betty McLean Travel, which is celebrating their 30th anniversary in business in Naples. She is a past director of the Forum Club. Please welcome to introduce our speaker, Mary Ann Ramsey. Mary Ann.
And good afternoon. I've had the pleasure of being involved with Virgin Galactic since their space tourism and accredited space agent program began. This afternoon, it's my honor to introduce Will Whitehorn, president of Virgin Galactic. Will has been with the Virgin Group for over 20 years and has played an integral part in expanding the Virgin brand into many new areas. Virgin has interest in over 200 companies, employing some 50,000 people worldwide. Virgin has business interests in everything from trains to planes and now spaceships. Will was appointed president of Virgin Galactic in 2004, and in addition, in 2007, he became a special advisor to Sir Richard Branson. I had the pleasure of meeting Will when the Virgin Galactic Space Tourism Program first began. Since then, I've found Will to be incredibly bright, as well as quite entertaining, whether he's explaining the components of a rocket engine or describing what it's like to be in suborbital space. Will has put together an incredible multinational team of professionals to implement the first private sector commercial space program. Will's taken a vision and has turned it into a reality of space travel for people, for real people. This was evidenced by the rollout of the spaceship on Monday night in the Mojave Desert in California, which I'm sure many of you saw in the news. We also have the pleasure of being joined by his lovely wife, Louise, or Lou. Will and his family live in East Sussex, and this is their first trip to Naples, and we hope it will be the first of many more. Please join me with a warm Naples welcome for Mr. Will Whitehorn, president of Virgin Galactic. Well,
good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for hosting us here today in Naples Beach. We've been having a lovely day and a half. It's been very relaxing after being in the Mojave Desert with 1,000 people unveiling a commercial spaceship during a hurricane. What a lot of people didn't realize, you may have seen on the news on Monday night that we rolled out the finished spaceship. We've been testing our carrier vehicle for quite a long time, and we've been testing our rocket motor. Now we're ready to start testing the spaceship. Now, in the Mojave Desert in early December, it's normally pretty cold at night. It's usually blue skies. You might get a bit of gradient wind in the morning and the evening. In fact, when we were preparing for the event of rolling out the spaceship, Sir Richard Branson didn't understand why we'd gone to the expense and cost of building a tented accommodation for the 1,000 guests. He said they can just stand in the desert. Well, as it turned out, within 2 hours of the events you saw on television, the entire structure that we had built for the event was utterly destroyed. And we only got the people out with 10 minutes to spare and out of harm's way, because we were hit by gusts of up to 115 miles an hour. But the amazing thing about it was, and I'm a great believer in sort of totems of things when they happen, is that beside the stage where Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger had been speaking only a couple of hours earlier, there was a model of the spaceship. And it was standing up, and it was facing the wind, and it was in its feathered position. When I got back the next morning to the site, and the fire marshal and the chief of police, and we decided we could go into the site to get some stuff, but the site was very dangerous because it was literally hundreds of tons of metal had all been wrapped up into a big ball, basically, and everything had been destroyed. The only thing left standing on the whole site was the model spaceship still facing into the wind. So that's a very good omen. So from now on, we're going to say, I went to Mojave and had a blowout at the spaceship. Anyway, what I'm going to talk to you about today is about space and about this particular project, and about how on earth you build a business plan to develop a business in the commercial sector in space. Now, the background as to why we've ended up doing this at Virgin Group is a typical Richard Branson story. And I'll take a minute or two to tell it before we get into the main body of what we're talking about today. We were in Morocco, of all places, in 1996. Steve Fossett and Sir Richard Branson were preparing to try and fly a balloon around the world. And as happens, Buzz Aldrin turned up to wish him well, who's an old friend, and the weather wasn't good, so we were sitting in a bar in Marrakesh with Buzz Aldrin. And Richard asked the question. He was just, in the way he does, laterally think, he's saying, Buzz, why did they never try and launch rockets into space by carrying them up in balloons to high altitude instead of trying to launch from the ground? And Buzz turned and said, well, gee, Richard, they did. He said, when I was in the US Navy, we actually experimented with balloon launches of rockets into space. And he said, of course, the X-15 project happened with the US Air Force, where they were launching a space plane into space. He said, but all of that got thrown away because of the need to get to the moon before the Russians and the lack of money becoming available as the space projects were bankrupting the US government in the mid-60s. They cancelled everything else, and NASA just went for the one thing. And it became wedded to ground-based rocketry. So anyway, the next day, as Richard does, he phones me in my room in the hotel and he says, you're going back to London tomorrow, aren't you? He said, go and register the trademark of the Virgin name for space travel immediately. So I went to the trademark people when I got back to London and I found out actually he'd registered it 15 years earlier himself and he'd forgotten he'd registered it. So a year after that, we began seriously to start looking at technologies for commercializing space. Being an aerospace company ourselves and very experienced in commercial transportation, both in new technologies in the railway industry, new technologies in aviation, we felt it was worth us having a look at it. So in 1999, we registered the name Virgin Galactic. And in 2001, we began to look at projects. And we alighted on one particular project because of something that we were doing, which I'll explain during the main part of the speech. We alighted on this particular project, and it was Burt Rutan's X Prize winning Spaceship One. Now, what I'd like to do, first of all, is show you, we just dim the lights for a minute or two. I want to show you a quick film. Now, I'm afraid this table probably won't be able to see it, so you might want to go and stand at the back, because it's quite a fun little film, this. I'll see if I can move the dais back a bit as well. So we could run this film just quickly. It's only 3 minutes, but it'll give you a good background to the project.
This will be a trip like no other. And we'll give those that travel with us a unique and life-changing perspective of our planet. For most of us, escaping the constraints of gravity is something we've only been able to achieve in our dreams, until now. Virgin Galactic is now on the final stretch of becoming...
Oh. I'm afraid it's not the video, because it was working fine. I'm afraid it must be something to do with the technology here, but we will... hopefully get there.
For most of us, escaping the constraints of gravity is something we've only been able to achieve in our dreams, until now. Virgin Galactic is now on the final stretch of becoming the world's first commercial spaceflight. Our suborbital space trips promise to be the most intense and wonderful experiences that our passengers have ever had. We, and I hope you, will be travelling on a spaceship owned and operated by Virgin Galactic. Our spacecraft have been designed so that each of our passengers will have the room and the freedom to enjoy the amazing sensation of weightlessness. Large panoramic windows will allow you to see clearly the curved Earth over 100 kilometers below and the colors of the fragile atmosphere protecting our vulnerable planet. We have spent many years on a frankly fairly futile search for technology that could be developed into a vehicle which would meet our specifications for safety, environmental impact and commercial viability, and of course the potential for a great customer experience. Burt Rutan, Spaceship One, and those flawless, history-making X-Prize flights in 2004 suddenly changed all that, and we grabbed the opportunity. I remember chatting to Brian Binney, the pilot on the X-Prize flight. He said it was a journey of contrast, describing the enormous forces that pinned him to his seat and the tremendous noise as the spaceship powered out of the atmosphere. Then suddenly, the dramatic and absolute silence of space.
The vibrations go away, the shrieking, shrilling noise of that rock motor disappears, and you get this instant karma of weightlessness. You cannot appreciate the experience just by looking at a magazine cover, just what it is like to take it in with your own eyes. And everything you feel in your body is the same way. It's wow.
Since the announcement in 2004, the project has reached and passed many important milestones. We have a truly inspiring design for our home at Spaceport America in New Mexico. An ever-increasing family of pioneering customers. And of course, beautiful new vehicles, now in an extensive test program before they start commercial service. I hope you will be as excited and inspired by Virgin Galactic's mission as I am. And see you up there.
Right. Now, the next thing I want to do is find that little clicker for the PowerPoint presentation I'm about to show you. I don't know if he's given it to me or not, but let's have a look and see if it's here. No. He's coming with it. That's it. Okay. So that's the project as it exists at the moment. It's based upon a piece of an idea. An idea that a man had to try and win a $10 million prize to get some people into space and win that prize with the first ever private spaceship. Now, Spaceship One that you saw at the beginning of that film was built for a cost of less than NASA's daily wages bill. And they had never achieved getting two people into space in 2 weeks in their history. But NASA has made amazing achievements. It's made amazing achievements in space exploration. It was an amazing achievement, the Apollo program. But it has not led to the kind of vision of space that Stanley Kubrick might have had with Space Odyssey 2001, A Space Odyssey, in 1969. So the first thing I began to do in looking at to building space systems was try and understand the history of NASA, try and understand where it had come from and where it was going. And it was quite obvious that it had lost its way in some areas. It wasn't its fault. It turned out that if you looked at it, it was really Congress's fault. Because it has not been guided, NASA. It's not been given a single purpose. Where it's given a single purpose of sending an exploratory probe to do this, or analyzing the polar ice cap, or looking at a piece of climate change science, or trying to understand what the Martian atmosphere does, it does very well on those missions. But with the space shuttle, it wasn't given a mission at all. It was just given a job creation program to try and take people into space without really understanding whether it was military applications they wanted it for or what. And therefore, they ended up building something based upon their fixation to ground-based rocketry, which every time it launches costs $1 billion of your taxpayers' money to launch. $1 billion a launch. I mean, it almost beggars belief. And the fact was that that is not really their fault either. Most of the people at NASA never wanted to build the shuttle the way it ended up being built. But it was to keep jobs going, it was to keep this going, it was to keep that going. They'd lost direction and purpose. And actually, I thought, well, if we end up with a commercial space sector, and there was an act that went through Congress in 2004 called the Commercial Space Launch Amendment Act that I had to go in front of Congress to give evidence for. And I thought, if we can create a commercial sector, we can take those burdens of doing things in low Earth orbit off NASA and let it get back to being an exploratory organization. Let NASA get back to not having to serve the International Space Station. SpaceX can build a rocket to do that. Not having to take people up there. We can eventually do that. If we can get the chance to develop a commercial business without government subsidy, we can actually learn how to do these things cheaply and efficiently and safely. Because if you come from the aviation industry, you have to learn to do things safely or you're not in business for very long. And NASA can get on with the job of getting us to Mars and getting us beyond this solar system. And the reason philosophically I think that matters is because everything about space is now crucial to our future as humanity. We don't realize how important space is to us because we've forgotten. We've forgotten that the GPS system combined with the weather satellites and the broadband system now gives farmers the information every day to not use that bit of fertilizer, to not use that pesticide, to lift that crop then, to put it in a container that's tagged with a GPS system so it doesn't get lost in a port or a railway marshalling yard. As a result, we're producing 10% more food just because of what space has done in the last decade. And as we can only just feed the world's population now and it's rising, space matters that much to us. And in so many other areas, a lot of the new drugs being developed, we're seeing coming on stream at the moment, have been developed because they've been developed in microgravity in the International Space Station, and the chemical combinations have been made there and then replicated down here. So it's crucial. Space matters more than anything else. So the background to what is going on that I'm going to tell you about today and our business plan for space tourism is the beginning of something. It's not the end of anything. It's the start of a program and a process that this company is determined to invest in. And a few American companies, Virgin Galactic's an American company, it's been set up as an American company, it's regulated by the US government, the FAA, but a few American companies like SpaceX, run by Elon Musk, the guy who developed PayPal, are in this game with us and we're working really closely together. And our aim is to take over the low Earth orbit activities and let NASA get on with being what it's so good at in the past and can be so good at again in the future, which is taking mankind to the edges of the solar system and beyond. So let me tell you a little bit about Virgin and why it's probably able to undertake a project like this where many companies, I can't really imagine American Airlines doing a project like this, to be quite honest with you. And I certainly can't imagine British Airways doing a project like this. And if they did, we'd probably object. But the reason that Virgin can take on a project like this is because we're really structured very differently from almost any other company you've ever come across in the world. We are much more like Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, combined with, say, a Japanese keiretsu like Mitsubishi, which has a brand name, and Warren's approach to investing is very similar to ours. We invest in lots of businesses. We bring a brand name with us and our expertise. We find partners who've got their own expertise. We form partnerships, and we get equity from either institutions, we put our own equity in, and we find that we create a structure which is not like a pyramidal classic incorporated company, or PLC as we call them in the UK. It's more like a branded venture capital organization. So each business is independent of the others. I have nothing to do with Virgin Atlantic, apart from that fact they're a sister company, we share a brand name, we share a common shareholder, one common shareholder, Sir Richard Branson. We will cooperate on projects, but we'll do them on a commercial basis. So we're getting a chief test pilot from Virgin Atlantic, for example, for our project. We pay them for them. But we do not have any equity or corporate link to them beyond the common shareholder. Therefore, we've managed to take a lot of risk out of our businesses in that if one business suffers risk, we can isolate it from the others. We're not a house of cards, which has allowed this extraordinary growth that we've had over the last few years and has allowed Richard to always have one project which is pretty extraordinary at any one time. And I'm lucky enough to be running the one that's pretty extraordinary at this time. The other background is Virgin's philosophy over the last 10 years. And we were definitely ahead of our time on this. This slide dates from 2003. And it basically was when we were explaining one of the backgrounds to why we were doing some of the things we were doing then. We believe that there's an incoming called peak oil. So we believe that by 2015 to 2020, you'll never see oil at under $100 a barrel again, just because of the sheer cost of getting the new resources out of the ground compared with the old resources. And we've used up most of the old resources. We will find new oil, but it's going to be much more expensive. That's what we mean by peak oil. Combined with the climate change debate, which regardless of where you stand on it and mankind's position, the insurance policy that most governments are going to take is probably going to make carbon more expensive. And therefore, if you're going to be a successful company in the second half of this century, you're going to have to be a carbon-efficient sector breaker. You're going to have to be better than everybody else at your use of resources and energy, because energy is going to be the key to the survival of our society over the next 50 years. So this is an industrial survival issue for us. So that led Virgin to do a whole range of quite extraordinary things during the last few years. We developed this train here. You see, is that working? No. We developed a train. In the Britain, we won the first government contract to take over the railways from the government. So we basically, the Amtrak equivalent, British Rail in the UK, was destroyed by the British government, and they re-established a set of private sector companies. Now, it really didn't work well to start with. It was difficult. But the government was determined to proceed with it. And the result has been that we've revitalized our railway in Britain with the private sector taking on the mantle of doing it. I actually worked on the design of this train, the tilting train, the Virgin Pendolino. top speed of 165 miles an hour, operates normally in Britain at 135 to 140 miles an hour. It has electromagnetic tilt, it's built like an aircraft with geodetic aluminium construction. It's the most fuel-efficient train in the world. It's not as fast as the French or the Japanese ones, but it's the most fuel-efficient. And that was our first move to diversify because of our belief that energy was going to get more expensive. And it's now the most profitable railway in the entire world. It runs all the mainline trains from London up to Birmingham, Glasgow, Manchester, Liverpool, the main hub of the long-distance network. We now carry 60 million people a year on those trains. 10% of airline flights in the UK are no longer into the airport, so they're able to concentrate more on long haul. It's meant Heathrow hasn't needed to be expanded as much. It's had a really dramatic impact, and it's profitable. There's a small amount of government subsidy goes into the track side, which is still a state-owned company, but we don't get subsidy. We pass any of that through to the track company that's owned by the state. So the success of that project led us to think about aviation and what we could do. And it turned out that both Boeing and Airbus, as manufacturers, are not keen on the idea of trying to de-wed themselves from aluminium and move towards new technology materials to make aviation more efficient. So in 2003, Richard being Richard and his friend Steve Fossett being Steve Fossett said, well, we're going to build our own carbon composite plane and show Phil Condit and others at Boeing and Airbus that you can build a big carbon composite plane. And Steve, why don't you fly it around the world? And Steve said, yeah, that sounds good to me. And they split the cost of doing it. Steve Fossett paid for half the project, Virgin Atlantic paid for the other half. And they built the world's first entirely carbon composite high altitude plane. And that plane flew around the world. Steve Fossett flew around the world on one tank of fuel. It was using less fuel per hour than an SUV at 50,000 feet. And of course, Steve got the world record, the ultimate world record in aviation. And as it did, as you do, if you look at this plane now and remember it when we're going through this presentation, we were already, by the time this was happening, planning for space. Because this plane is basically the test bed for the White Knight 2 carrier aircraft. So we decided in 2003-04, as this project was going on, I went into the factory and saw Bert building the spaceship. And I said to Bert Rutan, I said, what is that under there? He said, I see, sir. And eventually Bert, having been all top secret about it, eventually couldn't resist himself and showed me the spaceship. I was pretty amazed. It took me about an hour to understand. I went outside, got on the phone to Sir Richard and said, you won't believe this. He's building a da-da-da-da spaceship. Da-da-da, the global flyer. I think we've got to get onto this pretty fast. So we eventually persuaded Bert to tell us who the customer was, which was Paul Allen. Richard phoned him. I went over to Seattle with a couple of colleagues. We signed a deal before even the spaceship had been finished or built. We bought all the technology rights to commercialize it in the future. And the reason that we were really interested in it was actually going back to my own personal experience as a kid. My grandfather was quite a famous British inventor, and he invented the world's first petrol electric car. And at the time when he invented that in 1927, it ended up running all of London's buses. But as fuel got cheaper after the Second World War, the petrol electric buses were abandoned. And it was too far ahead of its time to be mass produced as a commercial car. It needed big rheostats. It didn't have modern electronic technology. And it took 70 years for the Toyota Prius to come along. Now, with that experience in my own head, and looking back at what I was saying to you earlier about NASA, and looking at what Bert was doing as we bought those technology rights, the reason we bought them is because we realized that actually this was the way to get to space. And NASA had actually led the way in the 1960s. That's a thing called the X-15. That flew into space 200 times in the early 60s, in secret largely. Nobody knew it was going on. But this was the technology that NASA had to abandon in order to fulfill the political directive to get to the moon by 1969. And this was where they were way ahead of the time, but the problem they had was just like my grandfather's car, the materials technology of this was titanium. Composites were in their infancy. If you had a composite surfboard by 1970, you were lucky, let alone a composite aeroplane. But they showed the way to the future. And the data they produced from this was really exciting. And Bert Rutan worked at Edwards Air Force Base when this thing was being flown. And a friend of his died on re-entry in it. Because the problem with this and the later shuttle is they were planes that went up and they tried to re-enter the atmosphere as aeroplanes. And then they were trying to land on this concrete of air, which is just like trying to land a flying boat on water, which I've done. Landing a flying boat is really hard. It's like landing on concrete. And the atmosphere is just like that. So that made him think a lot about what to do in the future. It made us think a lot about the fact that it was possible to do this kind of stuff, and NASA had at one time done it. So we began to move forward with a system which basically If you look at what happened during the Spaceship One program, there were some really special things that BERT had achieved. And I'll just run through what they are. What BERT had achieved during that program was that he'd used an air launch system to get people into space. Now, an air launch system, which was a two-stage system, an air launch system means you don't have to try and push people off the ground in an incredibly dangerous few hundred foot high stack with a 1 kiloton nuclear explosion under it, 500 million gallons of water to stop it shaking apart. I mean, no wonder the failure rate is so high in ground-based rocketry. It's just intrinsically dangerous. So air launch, a carefree re-entry using this feathering device you might have seen in the movie. Rather than having to fly a flight profile, change the thing into what's like a Mercury capsule from the 60s and drop it back in, then form it back into a glider and land. And with 100% composite construction, light, strong, resilient material, which is not going to break up, which is much more heat resistant than metals, which doesn't expand and contract by 8 feet like the shuttle does. Then you have to put 1 million tiles under the shuttle to cover up the gaps in the aluminium created. Then one of the tiles falls off and you're all dead. Not a good way to do things. So what we did was we took our Global Flyer project, we took BERT's Spaceship One project, and we began the process of building the world's first entirely carbon composite large aviation vehicle capable of lifting 17 tons to 50,000 feet and launching anything in space. You notice the very open construction. Well, that's so that other things in the future can be launched from it, not just our spaceship too. And this is what we've ended up with. We've ended up with an amazing vehicle, I have to say. Really quite special. If you look at White Knight 1 and Spaceship 1, we've got to Spaceship 2 and White Knight 2 in 5 years. Now, that may sound like a long time to you, but I can assure you in the history of projects like this, this is pretty quick stuff that we've done here. And the exciting thing about it is the commercial background to the company which has got us from this point to this point. It's got us from this point to this point because originally Virgin Group said to me, they said, one, you've got to find $10 million in deposits to prove there's some sort of market for this. And they wanted us to rebuild Spaceship One as a commercial vehicle. The original Spaceship One is now in the Smithsonian, but they want us to rebuild that because that was a fairly cheap option. But market research told us that if you were going to fly people into space, and let's say that they're going to fly into space as space tourists, then the first thing that they demand when you market research them is they want weightlessness. They want to be able to move around in a cabin. That's the number one experience people want, as well as seeing the planet Earth, the blackness of space, the planets out there, the curvature, the thinness of the atmosphere, experiencing the silence of space, and the other things you experience, like hearing atoms when you're re-entering, because it's a silent spaceship, so you hear every atom pinging off as you reach the top of the atmosphere. All those things, but weightlessness is what they want. Therefore, you need a big spaceship. You need a spaceship big enough for them to move around the cabin. If you're going to build a spaceship big enough for them to move around in the cabin, it can also be used for space science, and scientists can take their experiments up far more cheaply than going to the International Space Station and much more easily than putting it on an unmanned rocket. You know, these unmanned rockets go all the time up with experiments and come back, and half of them get destroyed at a cost of millions and millions of dollars. So we can revolutionize access to space, an entirely carbon composite system, cheap to launch at 52,000 feet. So we thought, right, we're going to build it like this with this open architecture and two hulls. Let's make business out of all of this. Let's make the whole thing business usable. So the usability of the spaceship is quite simply for space tourists and space scientists. The open space we've created means in the future, subject to US government permission, we can put an unmanned rocket on there and fire satellites into space at a tenth of the cost of today. If we're going to build two hulls to have this cantilever construction to give us a strength, we make this hull a science hull, so NOAA has now hired this hull, the National Oceanographic Atmospheric Administration, for an orbiting carbon project to try and understand the amount of carbon really in the atmosphere. And this hull is the training hull. So it's identical to the spaceship hull, and you go up in it the day before you fly as part of your 3-day training program. You get your final training in a real cabin, identical to the spaceship cabin. And once this spaceship has been dropped at 52,000 feet, the people in this half, the White Knight 2 becomes a zero-G plane. So you can get experience of zero gravity in and out of the cabin, how to get in and out of your seat properly. And then uniquely, and this is the first aircraft in the world ever to be able to do this, the aircraft can turn itself up on its side, fly around in circles and become a flying centrifuge, and can pull a continuous 7G of gravity. Not even a fighter can do it for as long as this thing can do it. And that's, of course, because it's been released of its weight by then. And this strength of this construction is so great. This piece across here is 140 foot across. It's the largest single piece of carbon composite ever made in human history. Therefore, it's the world's biggest surfboard. It gives you an incredible glide aspect ratio. For any of you interested in aviation, the glide ratio on this thing is about 1 in 30. So it becomes one of the most efficient gliders ever built. And the spaceship's a glide ratio of less than 1 in 10, so it's not quite as efficient a glider, but it does come in for a glide in its last section of flight. So I'm just trying to move this on. There we go. So, we've ended up with a system with lots of other potential uses in the future. Again, all subject to regulation by the FAA, all subject to government approval in the future, but all of these things can be done. So we can build a business plan. We can build a business plan based on space tourism initially and become profitable, but the investment opportunity is that in the long term, you've got tourism, you've got science, you've got training. You've got alternative White Knight 2 payloads, you've got satellite launch capability. You've got patented intellectual property which can be used for the aviation industry to increase its efficiency enormously in the next two decades. Because we're being licensed by a new division of the FAA called AST, this is licensed as a space launch system, not as a commercial aircraft. So we can do things with the composites you couldn't do in a normal commercial aircraft. For instance, this aircraft has the world's first spun carbon composite control cables. We're not using steel cables to fly it anymore. Never have they been used before. We patented those. And they can reduce the cost so considerably of space launch, and they can reduce the cost then of this of normal aviation as well. And we actually managed to get a second round investor in this year, which is the Sovereign Wealth Fund of Abu Dhabi, who are prepared to put $280 million into the project, and that's now going through a US government regulatory process of approval as a foreign investor as well. It is a country which doesn't seem to like to take people's money too much. It's quite difficult to invest in America sometimes, which is a strange thing, but happens to be true. Anyway, this is the actual profile of the spaceship that you're flying. Maybe we should switch the lights down again a little bit just to see this, because it's quite a dark slide. That's perfect. So you've paid $200,000. I haven't gone off to Costa Rica with it. We've built a spaceship, which we have actually now built. You've had your 3 days training. You get on board. You sit in that spaceship. You're launched into space. And you're launched into space by being dropped. Rocket motor fires. Within 6 seconds, you've broken the sound barrier. Within 12 seconds, you're doing 2,000 miles an hour. Within 14 seconds, you're doing 2,500 miles an hour. Within 20 seconds, you're doing 3,000 miles an hour. You're pulling 3G. And given that this audience is slightly more mature than the average US Air Force pilot, you're actually finding that G much easier to cope with than the average US Air Force pilot. Because the older we get, and I can attest to this from my own flying history, at 50 years old, I find no problem with G now at all. I find it as easy as peasy to take. Because actually, the older we get, the more we can cope with it, the better we can cope with it. So much so that Chuck Yeager was telling me that when he was a kid, Chuck Yeager, I had dinner with him not long ago, and he said, Will, do you still smoke? I said, actually, I do have the occasional cigarette, Chuck. Yeah, he said, well, don't stop till you've been in space. And I said, why is that? He said, because smoking thickens the blood. And apparently, when he was flying the Bell X-1, by smoking much more than the others, he worked out that actually he didn't black out in space. Now, of course, it wasn't very good for him, and he then stopped smoking immediately, because smoking is bad for you. But the point I'm trying to make is actually our older arteries and veins that we have are much better at coping with both space flight and, funnily enough, with G-forces than a younger person's. Hence, our oldest customer is 91 years old this year. Professor James Lovelock, the inventor of the Gaia theory of how the Earth works as a living organism, who cut his teeth as a scientist at NASA in the early 70s, Professor James Lovelock has just done his centrifuge training. And he's pulled 6G with no problem. And he had a heart triple bypass when he was 57. As long as you're fit and healthy, this is a very easy thing to do. So anyway, you're going into space. You've got the 3G on your back. You get up there. Silence has arrived. Gravity is gone. And you're going to float around the cabin. And you're going to look at the world around you. You're going to see the thinness of the atmosphere. You're going to have a life-changing experience. Eventually, you'll get back in your seat as gravity comes back on again. You've meanwhile feathered the spaceship into this feathered position so it can drop into the atmosphere rather than having to fly a flight profile. You come through, you then re-feather, and you become the world's highest ever glider. You're gliding at the same height that the U-2 flies at. So you're still seeing the curvature of the Earth, and you have a beautiful flight down right through the atmosphere, and you land at the runway. And then the White Knight 2 that's been training the next day's people comes in and lands behind you. Sorry, that's my phone going down. Now that, out of interest, is something that's been done at a cost per person of $200,000. You're getting 8 people to space. the entire cost of this entire project, from the beginning of what I described to you and filing the name 10 years ago, to getting to the finished spaceships and then building the 5 commercial ones, doing through all the licensing, getting to operate at the spaceport in 2012, the whole cost of that would be $450 million as a project. Now that sounds quite a lot of money, but to be honest with you, that's less than half a single shuttle flight. And to give you an idea of the environmental output of this project, the whole 10-year program to carry 50,000 people to space will have less environmental impact than a single shuttle flight. It is that dramatic what we've done to the technology of access to space with this project. Yes, we're not getting into full orbit with this project. The important thing about the project is we're not getting all the way there. We can't do what the shuttle can do yet, but we can do an awful lot of things for an awful lot less money. And we can make a business work without any help from a government or the state sector. And that's the really important thing to prove. Ourselves and Elon Musk at SpaceX and some of these other new private space companies, since that act was passed by the US government in 2004, we've created 12,000 jobs and $1.5 billion of investment in creating a new commercial space age. And I think it's going to be a great time ahead. Just moving on, this is the White Knight about to begin. You can see, if you look at the little Richard Branson and the little Burt Rutan in the far corner, it gives you some idea of the sheer scale of this thing. It's massive. That's it flying. Now, you know what? It looked pretty good, but it didn't look quite right. I couldn't understand what it was, and in a few minutes we'll show you what it looked much better than that. This is the spaceport. This is being built by the state of New Mexico. We're the first anchor tenant. A few other private space companies are going to be moving there as well. That's going to be near Las Cruces beside White Sands Missile Base. Again, for safety reasons, it's a great location. You've got no population on the ground. You've got completely clear airspace above because it was set up in 1946 for the White Sands missile base. So we can use the airspace without any commercial vehicles ever coming near us. And it's a really beautiful location. It's been designed by Lord Foster, or Norman Foster, the famous British architect. And it's the world's first aviation facility that's entirely carbon neutral. It uses geothermal power from the ground, solar power on its roof, and the gradient winds coming in and out day and night to keep it cool. And it looks pretty cool as well. So here we've got from a situation of a dream 10 years ago to the first business up in the top corner, Virgin Space Tours or Virgin Galactic. Virgin Galactic Space Tours, that's going to be our first business. We have over 310 customers signed up. We've now got over $43 million in deposits. And we now have the prospect of creating a science business subject to government approval out of it, a cargo business subject to government approval again, and eventually, of course, this is the beginning of a way to get around the planet outside the atmosphere rather than inside the atmosphere. So this barnstorming phase of people coming because they want to go to space is going to have big knock-on effects further on down the line. The people who sign up now are like the people who would go in the Ford Trimotor in 1929 or went on the Boeing Clipper between London and New York in 1939. In 1939, if you wanted to travel transatlantic on the new Boeing Clipper flying boat that had just been developed, it cost you in today's money $89,000 a ticket. But those people bought every single ticket in those 6 months before the war broke out. And they were the people who pioneered transatlantic travel that today, instead of being $89,000, is $890. Now, there are some other proposed systems. This one hasn't been built. The company went Chapter 11, I think. And again, they were trying to get into space, but they took a very engineering approach. And I think they didn't take a very good approach to re-entry. Tries to fly into space like a little Learjet and fly back again. But again, if you were to go in the cabin of it, you can't even move around. So why would you buy that? This is Jeff Bezos of Amazon. And nobody really knows what Jeff Bezos of Amazon is up to, but he's building something quite interesting out in Texas. But it looks like it's going to be a science vehicle. This is a little thing called the X-Core rocket plane, which, again, has not been built, but a guy has designed it. And, you know, one day we might even carry that up. It only carries one person as a passenger, though. This one, now, I'm a brave man, but I'm not going to get in that either. This has actually been designed. In fact, they have built part of this. They built the lower half, and it got to 67 feet about 6 months ago. And it's actually been designed by a guy called John Carmack, who designed the Doom computer game in the very late 90s and made a fortune. He's a computer games designer. But clearly he has a vision of going to space, which I don't think really matches the rest of us. And then there are these guys from Denmark who've actually bought an old Russian SS-18 missile and think, oh, let's put a person in the head instead of a nuclear weapon. and launch you into space. And then, of course, you'd come back like a little capsule and you'd land with a parachute and all the rest of it. Now, you see, the thing is, it's slightly lacking in the customer experience and the kind of shirt sleeves environment. So I don't think that'll be happening. However, this is happening. This is Mojave on Monday afternoon. That's the finished spaceship rolled out for the public worldwide to see for the first time. And if you can see what I mean now, the intrinsic, you know, I'm a great believer, if it looks right in design terms in aviation, it's going to be right. Now we've married daughter to mother, we're there. It looks intrinsically right. The mothership is called Eve. The first White Knight II is called Eve after Sir Richard Branson's mother. And the first spaceship is obviously called the VSS Enterprise. There would be no other name for it. And here it is that night, just before it was named by Governor Schwarzenegger, the VSS Enterprise, who did a fantastic speech that night. It's actually online on the Californian government website. You've got to watch it. It's such a good speech. He goes, "I love this spaceship number 2 project." And this is our team. That's myself and all of the team who are building it at the moment. This is the Virgin team, who are managing the overall project, and then Scaled Composites, who are the manufacturer we're working with, have another 190 people working on it out in Mojave at the moment. But I mean, this is a team of 280 people. In 5 years, we've built that. And that's what I mean, that NASA needs direction and it needs help and it needs to get back to exploratory, because they've got 90,000 people. And they're just not able to do enough because they're not being given the freedom of a project that they can be given clear direction on for a clear future. And I have the highest regard for NASA and the people who work there. And they've been incredibly helpful to us over the last 5 years. But the US public are funding something at the moment that needs to be changed. And if there's a commercial sector to take up the low Earth orbit part of it, they will have then the freedom to go and be the future of mankind, which is what NASA should be. Anyway, thank you very much for your time. I'll take some questions as well. I'll move this back forward again.
Well, I can tell you that our audience was hanging on every word. We may be a little senior and mature in age, but this captures our imagination. We have a couple of gifts for you. To remind you of your visit here, we have a book about Naples, Florida.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Picture book, and also about Marco Allen, Culture and History.
That's great.
I'll hold on those
Thank
for you.
You.
Our members have some questions for you, several dozen. Marian Ramsey has boiled them down to the essential few, and she will now come and ask you some questions.
Okay.
Marian.
That was fantastic. Well, we have some great questions. We sort of have them in three categories, some about Will personally, some about the investment, and some about the space experience. So we'll start with the personal. Please tell us a bit about yourself and what influenced you to take on this career.
Oh, God, that's a difficult question, isn't it? I was brought up in Scotland, in Edinburgh in Scotland, and I am Scottish. I sometimes even wear a kilt when I'm doing presentations like this, but I decided to let you off from having to see that today. I think when I was a very young kid, I was fascinated by aviation. I was the little boy that my parents had to drive me out on a Saturday morning to Edinburgh Turnhouse Airport. While I had my nose up against the glass, they had to drink disgusting coffee in the airport cafe, waiting for me to stop looking at the aeroplanes. I was also, I watched the moon landings. And my mother said to me as I was watching Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on the moon, she said, "One day, Willie, you'll be going to space as well," in her Scottish accent. And I kind of took that to heart. And when I was 16 years old, I was an RAF cadet, and I learned to fly at the age of 16. I went to university when I was 16 and studied economics at university, because actually I found that really interesting. I was reading a lot at that time about the economics of Concorde and why it wasn't working, and also about what was happening to the space program. I was always fascinated by transport economics. So I did economics and industrial history. So I didn't actually study engineering at university, but I'm kind of like quite a natural engineer. I like engineering a lot, and I kind of see it in the context of industrial history and what we're doing. So after I left university, I flew helicopters for a couple of years in the North Sea to the oil rigs and doing search and rescue work, and had an accident. And my father just died. My mother said, "No, Willie, you've got to stop doing this because you've got to come and get a job, which is, on land." So I became a graduate trainee with a very big travel company called Thomas Cook that many of you might remember and have heard of, and then went to work for a bank. And then I got a call from this guy called Richard Branson, who I'd always admired a lot, even at that time, back in the 80s, and I've worked there ever since. So really, my career has been a bit of a jack of all trades, definitely master of none, but my interest in this particular project has been right from the word go. It's been the thing that's become a passion for me, to the extent that I've actually, you know, there were a lot of people in Virgin who weren't, you know, obviously for good reason, weren't always that keen to do this, because it's risky, and it was difficult to prove the business case, and I actually took a sort of big cut in salary come and do this, and I've got another job as well in my spare time. So I run the world's leading technology PR agency as well, which is based in San Francisco. So I do that part of the time, and I do this the rest of the time, because I was passionate about it. And actually, most of the team who work on this, you know, we're not paying the highest salaries in the world for this team, you know, and their incentive is really to see something quite remarkable happen and be done. So that was a very long answer, I'm afraid.
That was good. That was good. These two are about investments.
Yes.
And can you tell us how Virgin Galactic is being financed?
Yep.
And can you tell me how much money
has Virgin Investment Virgin project? Invested. I mean, it's very simple. The project to date has been entirely financed by Sir Richard Branson. To get where we are to the spaceship, he's put over $150 million in so far. The whole business plan will take about $450 million. We've managed to raise second round financing by Abar from Abar Investments, who are the people who've just bought a big stake in GM, I think, and Chrysler, who are a sovereign wealth fund. They're going to put some money in. Virgin Galactic has not had any state funding whatsoever. So it's an entirely privately financed project. Which makes it a lot easier, actually.
These are sort of about the space benefits of space travel. What are the possible benefits of your space program to conventional air travel?
Well, I think very quickly, this system is not going to be capable of taking people around the planet outside the atmosphere, but it heralds a system that could. And the thing that we need to get to the next stage in the future, is a new type of engine. And luckily, there's a company in America, a company in Britain, and a company in Japan all working on one. It's called a reaction engine. If we could put an engine in that spaceship that could breathe air, like a jet engine when it's in the atmosphere, and then be able to use oxygen outside the atmosphere, which is provided into it, if we could get an engine like that, which would have a little nanocarbon heat exchanger in it, I think would be the way to do it. If we can build an engine like that, this system will be ready to eventually start flying people around the world, and you could do, you know, Naples Beach to Australia in 2 hours. But you're going to need to have that thick blood for the G-forces, because there'll be a few of them.
You talk about taking people into space. What's your definition of space?
Right. Our definition of space is to cross the Kármán line. So NASA's old definition of space in the 60s was 50 miles, but as actually the sophistication of knowledge about space came along, that was extended, and the Russians' definition of space had been 100 kilometers. That's the Kármán line. Now, this spaceship is going to be capable of going to between 110 and 130 kilometers, depending on the mission profile. If you're doing some space science, you'd probably go a bit higher to get more microgravity for a longer period of time. If you're only going to see the Earth and experience weightlessness, to get lower Gs, you probably go to about 110 kilometers. So we'll be in the true definition of space by anybody's standards.
This is a good question, and you actually talked to the students yesterday
at
community school about this. Could the program survive a mishap or catastrophe, and how do you guarantee safety?
That's a very good question. The airline industry has thrived despite the early accidents it had because of the sheer weight of force of the momentum of the airline industry as it developed the first early safe planes like the Ford Trimotor, the Lockheed Electra, the DC-3, the Boeing Clippers. Those early aircraft gave people the confidence to keep flying. However, you might remember that the Hindenburg, despite its intrinsic safety, when Adolf Hitler had to fill it with hydrogen because the US wisely, thank you very much US, wouldn't provide him with helium in 1936, it had a terrible accident. And that was the end of that type of travel, because it already hadn't got enough confidence in it by that time to keep going. So, you know, if we were to have something mishap during the test program, I think we might be able to overcome that, because that would be part of the safety learning curve. If we have a mishap in the early years of service, it probably would be difficult for the project. If it's been going for 10 or 15 years and something happens, as long as it's not incompetence, which I pretty much hope it won't be, then I think it could survive that. But, you know, you are in a situation here whereby we are doing something a lot more safely than it's been done before. Current accident rate for space is in the sort of 1 to 2% category. It's as dangerous to go to space at the moment as it is to climb right to the top of Everest. But still, hundreds of people every year attempt to climb right to the top of Everest and pay over $100,000 to do so. We're trying to get this to the general level of aviation safety that people are experiencing nowadays in private aviation. It'll take time to get to that. But from the word go, it's going to be safer than driving your car or going on a bus. And actually, it's probably going to be safer than sitting at home, which is one of the most dangerous things that you can do. You know, a normal airliner like Virgin Atlantic level of safety, we've never had an accident in Virgin Atlantic in 25 years of operation. We've got a really strong safety culture that's world renowned. And we, you know, you have a, your chance of dying on a Virgin Atlantic plane is about 1 in 2.5 million. That's really what big, wide-bodied Western jets have now got to in low levels of safety. We're not going to get there immediately, but we're going to get well up beyond anything that's ever been seen before in this kind of aviation. We're going to get to a good level of safety that people are going to be prepared to take as a risk. And it's certainly going to be as safe as any of the other activities that people normally undertake.
There's a question about who builds the engines and who builds the shell.
Well, we do, basically. Ourselves and our partners, Scaled Composites, Bert Rutan's company, are building the prototype. Then Virgin itself is going to take on the building of the actual working vehicles. Now, we don't really want to be in that position. You know, I have a good enough business head to know that if you're going to be an operator something, you don't want to also be your own manufacturer. You can't have much leverage on yourself, contractor or otherwise. But the fact is we couldn't actually find a manufacturer capable of building this. You know, only Bert's technology is capable, and Boeing and Airbus and people just can't build this stuff yet. They've got so wedded to aluminium, they have not been spending enough R&D dollars on composites. Hence, you've seen what's happened with the Boeing 787. Originally supposed to be an all-composite plane, it would have made it 60% more fuel efficient. Now it's only partially composite. It's only going to be 30% more fuel efficient, and it's 4 years late. Because actually, they're stuck in their ways. They want to try and wed composite materials to aluminium, and it's not an easy thing to do. So we've had to become our own manufacturer for this project. And, you know, one day, hopefully, we can sell that manufacturing off to one of the big prime manufacturers, and they can take it over from us. But if we're going to get through those problems I was talking about at the beginning of the speech tonight, the things about the energy supply, the peak oil coming in the future, some of the climate issues, then the companies that are going to survive in the future are the ones that blaze the way towards better ways of doing things. So, you know, we've taken a very conscious decision as a group to take R&D into our own hands because no one else is doing it at the moment. And it's paying dividends for us just now. And I think, you know, you'll see a lot more companies start to take this approach. In fact, quite a lot of companies are starting to take just this approach at the moment. And I think, you know, the new car manufacturers who are blazing the way with much more efficient electric cars are forcing the big manufacturers to rapidly start going back into R&D for the first time. And that's a good thing. You know, GM has sat on technologies for 25 years that it should have been forging ahead with. And now it's finally starting. I know it's had to go through Chapter 11, government ownership, and out of Chapter 11, but it is actually starting to move forward and actually look at much more energy efficient futures. So I think you'll see this trend line of much more push from the operators of things into how they're manufactured really continue apace over the next few years.
And lastly, what's the itinerary for the space flight, the length of trip, miles and time?
Yes.
And also, what accommodations are there for passengers for human body functions?
Ah, yes. Well, you'll have to buy a ticket and find out. Human bodily functions are a funny thing, actually. You know, you've probably seen a bit of debate in the newspapers about, wouldn't it be great if we all became vegetarians? Have you seen that debate? Because we'd save the planet. And let's stop producing beef from corn in big factories in the Midwest and all the rest of it, and let's get back to eating more vegetables. Well, the problem with people who make statements like that is they're looking at one side of an equation and not the other. The way the human body works is that after a month, if you became a vegan vegetarian, you produce an extra 0.5 litres of methane a day out of your bottom. And for that reason, therefore, there's no carbon benefit from doing anything of the regard that you've heard people saying. Now, when it comes to bodily functions in a spaceship, you clearly don't want to be doing them. This is a two-hour trip. We let you go to the loo before you leave. And we've done quite a bit with you that morning to make sure there's not going to be an issue, which I won't go into detail, but ultimately you also get a thing called the NASA nappy. which the guys on the shuttle wear, guys and ladies on the shuttle wear when they're going up into space, because the shuttle doesn't have a toilet either. They have to wait till the International Space Station before they can do that. So just in case somebody gets caught short, they'll be wearing a NASA nappy. What is the itinerary for the space trip? Well, basically, the itinerary is about 3.5-4 days. You'll go down to that site at Spaceport America in New Mexico. Probably drop your loved ones off in Santa Fe on the way, because Las Cruces doesn't have quite the amenities of Santa Fe, which is a beautiful city in the mountains. You will train for 3 days pretty hard. You'll get lectures, first of all, on the whole concept. You'll have to give informed consent, just like you would do to go scuba diving or any of these other activities. So we will explain all the possible risks and all the things we've done to mitigate the risks so you can take your final decision. We will put you through simulators again, do your last medical. Then you'll go up in White Knight 2, as I was describing during the speech, to do that final training, and then you're going to go to space. In the whole history of space, there's only been 500 people have gone. From Yuri Gagarin right the way through to the last shuttle flight we had a few weeks ago, that's 500 people. We're going to be taking 700 in year one alone. It's going to have a dramatic impact on people's perception. And the people who sign up are going to be part of that. You'll be joining this interesting group of people, like Victoria Principal, Brian Singer, the film director, who's just directed the new X-Men films, Philippe Starck, the designer, Sarah Brightman, the well-known opera singer, who's one of our latest clients to just sign up. These are people who actually all share the same thing I share with them, and Sir Richard Branson shares. They all watched the moon landings in 1969, and somebody told them that one day they'd be going to space. Well, hopefully some of you will be part of that future with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks again to all our guests. Thanks to our students, and thank you again, Will Whitehorn. Thank you.